Welcome to theconversation.org, Making Sense of These Times web radio program.
Could it be? Yes, it could. Something's coming, something good. If I can wait, something's coming. I don't know what it is, but it is gonna be great. Hear that click.
You're listening to our series of Suzanne's readings from Brian Swim's The Universe is a Green Dragon. We would love to hear from you. Email us at suzanne@mightycompanions.org. And now, here she is, Suzanne Taylor.
Well, here we are for episode number 4 of this magic journey into The Universe is a Green Dragon, where we are actually being programmed to experience ourselves as the possibility of the human, that Brian is so incredibly masterful at translating from the elements of the physical world around us into the sensing of our very being that hooks us all up with the primordial force that gave rise to everything. And here we are at the tip or the edge of creation, the most awesome thing that creation has brought forth, the awesomeness being our capacity for self-reflection. And I was listening to Brian's tape series, The Canticle of the Cosmos, which is absolutely wonderful. And he was talking about the capacity for self-reflection as a move in the universe being as awesome as the creation of planets. I mean, this is something, that this capacity for something so beyond the beyond, not linked to the physical, and yet inexorably a part of it, has entered so that the universe can look at itself and appreciate itself. We are the ground of being in which the universe can actually reflect upon itself. And isn't that a glorious thing? I mean, if you're going to make something as wonderful as a universe, wouldn't you want there to be a capacity to appreciate it? So here we are. Now, we have moved through these primary forces where Brian, in the first major section, was talking about cosmos as primary revelation, whereby we are in a revelatory event. We're not just on something using it. We're part of something just constantly opening and being revealed. And he talked about all the primal forces that are the underpinnings of that and the energetic of that, where we're filled with creativity, primordial and pervasive. We are held together by allurement, the sense of attraction, and our destiny as enchantment, where we are the beautiful expression of this miracle under threat from evil, from cosmic risk, because cosmic risk is the chance the universe took that if it gave us free will, the capacity to choose, this additional move in the universe of self-reflexive awareness, creatures that are free can go wrong. Cosmic risk is what he calls that underlying danger with which we live, but also which spurs us onward, that keeps us transcending ourselves, without which we would never have amounted to what we amount to now. Brian is wonderful about squaring us with the things that perhaps we would find unbearable, and do find unbearable as we attempt to navigate this strange thing called life. Well, we're now into epiphanies of the earth. And epiphany, in the dictionary, is a spiritual event in which the essence of a given object of manifestation appears to the subject as in sudden flashes of recognition. So we're going to see the essence of things in flashes of recognition. And so we've seen the essence of the sea in what I read last time. And the essence of the sea is to absorb things, is to be the conduit that makes change happen. And this energy of change is the energy of creation itself. And Brian is just taking us closer and closer, more and more viscerally, into the sensing that the sea is us. We too have the power of absorbency. And the way he starts this whole thing, to become fully mature as human persons, is in this first paragraph of this sea section. We must bring to life within ourselves the dynamics that fashion the cosmos. So this dynamic of absorbency, we are going to take into ourselves, thanks to Brian, whereby we are going to create the human form of the central powers of the cosmos. So that's our big task that we're undergoing here. He talks about our task of world building. Isn't that nice? You and I are world building. So moving on from the capacity for absorbing things, which we access by developing sensitivity, and we do that by learning to listen, really pay attention, really be present in the now, is the key and the doorway to this capacity for absorption. And now we're going to move on to land. What is land all about? Thomas, now we can consider land, the soil, rocks, mountains, continents, and elements, matter. In particular, I want to tell you how land shows the power of linking back, of reconnecting, of remembering. The cosmos remembers in its own way, and we can see this most clearly in the land. The elements themselves are frozen memory. They present to us the work of supernovas billions of years ago. A sturdy memory, certainly, when we have difficulty keeping track of our phone numbers, but the shape of the elements has been preserved and remembered through all these eons. The elements show us the original form given them at their emergence into the universe. The crust of the earth holds the storybook of life's adventure, especially of the last 600 million years. The gneissic rocks, and that's G-N-E-I-S-S-I-C, of Greenland, capture in their crystalline formation the story of our Earth 4 billion years ago, when Earth was just leaving its molten state. The journeys of the continents as they crashed against each other and floated across the oceans on the spongy rock of the mantle has been recorded in the mountain ranges, seas, and trenches left behind by the collisions. The cosmos desires to remember, but it does not always succeed. On Earth, this cosmic dynamic of memory has succeeded with such a diversity of remembering that even two-legged creatures plagued with tonsillitis and tax worries have evoked the great story from the rocks. Youth. How have we failed to develop the cosmic dynamic of memory, then? Thomas, our understanding of memory is anthropocentric, to begin with. We have limited ourselves unnecessarily. Youth, what do you mean? Thomas, your arms are memory poured into flesh, fiber, and bone. Do you understand that? Youth, no. Thomas, consider a mountain goat. These animals have the ability to stand on a tiny ledge of rock with the wind blowing and the rains crashing down on them. Their hooves, in particular the outer shell of the hoof surrounding the inner pad, allow them to get a hold on a small rock almost as if they were grabbing it with pliers. What we have to appreciate is that this adaptation required millions of years. The ancestors of present-day mountain goats lived on mountains, adjusting to the mountain shapes, the difficulties of gravitational pull, and everything else. Those shapes that were most successful in fitting into the mountain's reality were selected for survival, so that what we see now contains all that previous experimentation. The hoof is the memory of the ancestral tree. It didn't show up accidentally. It was shaped by the accumulated experience of millions of goats. The point is, matter remembers the elegant hoof. The genetic sequence enabling such a hoof to be fashioned becomes dominant in the gene pool, passing the hoof around to all members of the species. So you see what I mean when I say the hoof is permeated with memories from the past. From this standpoint, the hoof is those memories. Youth. But how does this pertain to the human? Thomas. Just as the hoof is memory, the human body is memory. Think of how many creatures are involved in the ancestral tree required for the creation of your fingers. When you lift your hand, you are lifting all the vast experimentation that led to that hand. There, before you, is the history of the great events of the universe. The biological exploration, the supernova explosion, all the significant moments of the last 20 billion years are remembered. Youth, but what does the remembering, Thomas, matter? Matter in the form of molecules. The sequence of molecules that make up your DNA is a sequence of memories. Do you see how the cosmic dynamic of memory relies on a particular event to show itself? We can't see memory's dynamic any more than we can hear allurement's dynamic. We can only look with astonishment at the genetic sequence of molecules captured, remembered, by the DNA in all cells. Youth, why is there memory? Thomas, we are investigating those powers of the universe required for its creativity, for building its outstanding events. The universe remembers so that it can benefit from the labor and awareness of previously existing beings. Why should it forget moments of tremendous cosmic or geological or biological beauty? Think of how many billions of creatures were involved in the accomplishment of the animal eye. What a tragedy if this were not cherished. Youth, how do we develop the power of memory in this cosmic sense, then? Thomas, begin by thinking of memory as an activity. Remembering is something that the universe does. For the cosmos, memory is the way the past works in the present. The universe doesn't want to waste anything. If it can get the past to do the work in the present, well, why not? Consider the oak tree. Proto-oak trees emerged some 250 million years ago. All that work, all that probing creativity, patience, and suffering that went into the creation of the oak was present in the acorn that unfolded into this great red oak here. History is captured by the acorn, so that when placed in soil, watered, and surrounded with air, the oak unfolds all the beauty that was enfolded into the tiny acorn. Think of the minerals moved this way, that way, by and through the oak tree as it emerges. What guides all that pushing and activity? What guides the decision to branch here and not there? What decides to avoid the dead end and choose instead this already tested and reliable course of events? The oak tree as a whole does, yes, because the remembered past is there, guiding, influencing, choosing, and affecting the development of the whole. In this sense, the past is present, actively working in the growing oak. Modern humans don't understand this. We regard history as something dead and gone. We live in the fingernail of the present and fail to realize how this cripples us. At best, we think history is 6,000 years old, something involving humans only, most of it irrelevant. We have convinced ourselves that our ancestors all tried to be like us but failed. We think they too would, if they could, devote themselves to a machine world, a bigger and bigger GNP, and a continent filled with consumers. Can you imagine if the plant world imitated us? If they regarded the creations and the lifestyles of their own ancestors as outdated, beneath them, not worth remembering? They would snub the lower forms and their photosynthesis, trying to do without that stupendous and permanent achievement of harnessing the sun's light. If the plants imitated us, life on this planet would wither in a week. So the question we should ask ourselves is this. What would happen, on the other hand, if we tried to imitate the plant world? What would happen if we began to see that the achievements of our ancestors are permanent creative advances, handed down to us for our benefit. To begin with, we would cherish the tribal peoples of the planet just as plants cherish photosynthesis. These peoples have lived with the rhythms of the planet for tens of thousands of years, fashioning skills and procedures over the ages that must not be lost in our rush to pave the earth asphalt. They established basic attitudes towards the primary realities of this world, and fashioned traditions that have endured difficulties that we can hardly imagine. They forged rituals and initiation rites to remind them that this earth is sole provider and sustainer of all life forms. To develop our cosmic dynamic of memory means that we assimilate the wisdom of all native peoples. They have accumulated knowledge that we cannot do without, wisdom that, should we lose it, we could never reproduce it. The achievements of the great classical civilizations must also be remembered, for they are permanent acquisitions of the planet, as crucial and as irreplaceable as tribal processes. During the times of the classical civilizations, humans remembered being. They were able to face the tremendous awe still found in all of Earth's religious and poetic utterances. It was then that humans first grasped, in a well-developed conscious awareness, the deepest reality of cosmic memory, for they realized that the universe cherished the creations of time, never losing anything of beauty. Because we have forgotten these insights, we industrialists suffer crippling fears of death. Instead of sinking into the joy of living, we bury our lives in trivia and pressurize distractions, anything to forget the fact that we are alive, in being, and destined for infinite delight. Youth, is this what you mean when you say we block cosmic dynamics when we forget, when we think we have no need of the past? Thomas, to forget the past? What can this really mean, other than to deprive ourselves of infinite power? The universe desires to break through into human form, but we cripple ourselves, insisting upon living in a fingernail's edge of our true heritage. We are just like some ignorant oak tree who insists upon ignoring all the efforts of the past, setting out to make its own leaves and own form. Impossible! Youth, but when are we like this? Thomas, in nearly everything. Even the most ordinary tasks show this. Take eating. Our relationship toward food is simply wrong. Instead of eating the natural foods Earth has created over eons of subtle experimentation, we stuff ourselves with fake junk put out by multinationals with less knowledge of the Earth than could be stuffed into an empty peanut shell, resulting in cancer, heart disease, and all the needless suffering associated with folly. We need to realize that from a biological point of view, eating is remembering. Why? Because food is rich in the information our bodies need. Through hundreds of millions of years, life forms learn to feed on each other. This means more than supplying fuel. It means supplying the informed sequences of molecules and amino acids required for our epigenetic unfolding. Our bodies wait for, expect a particular spectrum of foods. Not just anything will do. Particular molecule compounds are required, those that were fashioned by the millions of years of creative experimentation. Youth, but how is eating remembering? Thomas, many of our physiological patterns of activity depend on certain complex chemicals provided by natural foods. The physiological processes are the way the body remembers its ancestral heritage, and this heritage insists on particular natural foods for its remembering. When you eat grains, legumes, and good fresh meat and vegetables, you enable your body to remember its powers. Well, Suzanne is interjecting here. Isn't this an interesting addition to all of the body of information that we carry about this business of foods and natural foods and healthy living, healthy eating? have we ever really considered, as an aspect of this, this great chain of development in which what we are eating is not just some objective thing that happens to be good for you, but it's the whole history of the earth that is built in to this delivery to you of what belongs inside you. Now, I'm no great saint at this. I mean, I'm not even a junior angel. But I find this a very interesting perception, as Brian is always coming up with these different perceptions that add to a body of wise perception, yet another dimension, a much deeper dimension than the wisest one we had before. So back to Thomas. He had just said that when you eat all these healthy foods, you enable your body to remember its powers. It is similar to what happens when you leaf through an old photo album. The pictures key all sorts of memories, and you are flooded with the past coming alive within you. That's what eating is like. The foods enable patterns of activity to start up. If we understood that food was memory, we would stop our miserable eating habits. You. So, remembering includes eating habits. Eating is a form of memory. What other ordinary activities are memory? Thomas. Exercise. Oh, I'm going to get deeper and deeper in trouble here. Oh, how can I have read this book so many times, and yet. Ah, well, cosmic risk at play. Exercise. To exercise actually means to bring into action. When we exercise, we bring into action our ancestral memories. Our bodies remember that we lived in trees and forests. We need to crawl and climb and run if we are to develop our intellectual, emotional, and spiritual capacities. We did not emerge from an austere iceberg of a distant planet, but in the particularities of this earth and its forests. When we wander through the mountains, climbing and running, our bodies remember those deep patterns of behavior intrinsically tied to all that we are. We tend to think of exercise as losing weight, as trimming off the fat, but to exercise is to enable the body to remember its past, so that it can stretch out with all of its intertwined powers of being and thought and reflection. To remember is to know. To remember the great events of human history is to know them. We remember the tremendous creativity of Earth's history when we know the subtleties and complexities, the overall coherence of these stupendous events. To develop the power of memory is to deepen our knowledge. The difficulty with the word knowledge is its connotation of self-reflexive knowledge. We have belittled the word in our dualistic, anthropocentric usage. Knowledge is memory. To know is to remember. An engineer knows how to build a bridge because he or she can make present those procedures that have worked in the past. Thus, we see that our knowing and our remembering are present in the animal and plant worlds as well. You can understand now what I mean when I say we need to remember the universe. We need to study the cosmic story, the earth story, the human story, until we know its essential forms. A person who does not know the story of the universe is not yet living up to human destiny. Wow. That is a good statement, don't you think, says Suzanne? I mean, we are really just living in part of things when we go searching for our soul without being rooted in our eternality. On with Thomas. But this knowing is not only cerebral. To know the story of life includes eating natural foods. To know the story of human civilizations means feeling the profound intuitions they achieved. And to know the story of the universe means to allow the great numinous past to come alive in your present being. So he's going from the story of life as our very individual bodies, how we take care of them, and the story of civilizations is the wisdom that came to the collective, and the story of the universe is the numinous past, so much beyond telling, and yet there it is, coming alive in who we are. We are all of these, as the knowing, as the matter of the knowing, as the knowing of the matter. Youth asks, You know, this is so different from everything I was taught. I had never once thought of studying history in this way so that the universe could come alive in me. Isn't this also lovely, to think of the universe, says Suzanne, coming alive in us? Isn't that so much better than thinking of us struggling to get over our neuroses so that we can grab a little pleasure? Oh, what a different perspective Brian enables for us and creates. This is a great contribution of Brian. Thomas, commenting on this is so different from everything youth was taught. I realize that. The switch out of an attitude where the human is the center of everything to a biocentric and cosmocentric orientation where the universe and the earth are the fundamental reference is the radical transformation that we are presently involved with. It is disruptive. We are so quickly confused because we are accustomed to forgetting the earth and cosmos to concentrate on the human world. But when you begin to grow into this larger way of living, you will discover new freedom and a vast vision of being that makes the struggle worthwhile. Oh, Brian Swim, you are such a caller for our nobility, which is what makes the struggle worthwhile. We settle for so little, don't you think? Well, not if I have anything to say about it. And thank you, Brian, for putting the words in my mouth. All right, back to you. But it's so confusing, especially when I think of where to start. Thomas. Okay, folks. That's not what Thomas says. That's what Suzanne says. Here's where we start. Okay. Remember beauty and awe. Now, last we were going to start by listening very carefully, being present. So what we're going to do when we listen and be very present is we're going to, says Thomas, remember beauty and awe. Remember the stupendous achievements of our unfolding universe. Begin by memorizing that sentence, if you like. And begin at home. Remember the moments of beauty that you have already experienced. Reflect on your own life. What were the central moments to be remembered? Carve them on the inside of your belt. Fashion tapestries with the major events celebrated. Or paint symbols on your wall that will call them to mind. Put down a paragraph of language for each of your central moments of living on this planet. They are to assist you in your present. They are to empower you. Bring all these moments of awe, or difficulty, or endurance, or nobility into your present, and you will be already remembering in the way that you must. Now, Suzanne says, wouldn't that be a workshop? Just to ennoble yourself by yourself. By all the wonderful, to make a ritual, to ritualize your life, to mythologize your life, to make an archetype out of you, this great you that has gotten to here, to make yourself into that, wherever you are. Whether you're a slow learner from the last time or not, where the slow learner is the one who gets to go even deeper into things because it takes them so long to get there and they have to examine everything so carefully. So we're building here the life that is worth living. Back to Thomas. Leonardo da Vinci understood something about the work of memory. If he was captivated by a face, he would follow the person around for an entire day, if necessary, watching and studying and drawing. Not until he could reconstruct the face without looking would he be satisfied. This is what is meant by the beautiful phrase, learning by heart. He knew the face, and he had etched it into his being, into the deepest reaches of himself. He remembered the face because he had identified with this beauty so deeply that it lived through him. When we remember beauty, we become this beauty for the living present. Now, isn't that interesting, Suzanne says again, that the Leonardo da Vinci's of this world were so present in the now of things and so purposefully and intentionally absorbed the reality that they could perceive around them that they could come back out and work with it and create it. A very good little life lesson here about presence. Youth. But what about evil and sadness? Are these to be remembered too? Thomas. Yes, in a different way. In general, we remember, so that we can ignite and enhance life. This requires of us that we remember suffering, pain, and hardship. In fact, the body remembers damaging events of the past, even though these are often not remembered in self-reflection. The body remembers so that the mistake can be avoided in the future. It is essential, then, to remember evil. Feelings of guilt stem from this. The universe insists that we pay attention and remember our pasts, whether as individuals, societies, or species. We can be plagued by memories of error until we turn them over in our minds and penetrate them with clarity. Once we have snatched understanding from their core, we are released from our guilt. The lesson has been learned, the impasse overcome, and the spontaneity of creative activity returned, refreshed and effective once more. Oh, Suzanne likes this. Now, isn't this a wonderful case against denial? All those things we stuff and avoid because of the pain, but no, we must go into them to really perceive them, to really get what their message was, why they were wrenching us so. And it frees our creativity, even if the pain is not out of one's limited vision, but out of the hardship of being human, where death and disease, all of that, aren't there these moments of deep pain that the pain just drives us to wisdom? Those are those miracle cures that some diseases afford us, that they are so challenging that in fact they give us a life so much grander than ever. The last paragraph Thomas is speaking in this section on land says, "We cannot approach any satisfied existence as humans until we engage our capacities in this great work of remembering. We are uniquely fashioned to succeed. The dynamics that forge the fireball and the trillions of stars are at work within us as well, bringing into a single flaming intensity the whole vast epic of reality. What we eventually discover in our passionate remembering of the galactic, terrestrial, biological, and human stories is that a study of the universe is a study of self." And now we go on from land to life, another epiphany of the earth. Thomas, "The sea embodies cosmic sensitivity for us, the land, cosmic memory. Now let's look at life forms. What's the first thing you think of when you think of life?" Youth, "That's easy, death." Thomas, "That's what comes to mind?" "Well," says youth, "everything born is going to die." Thomas, "That's not exactly true." Youth, "What?" Thomas, "Some creatures don't die. In fact, for 2 billion years, the life forms on the planet Earth did not have death as an inevitable ending to life." Youth, "I don't understand." Thomas, "For billions of years, death was not a biological necessity. Nothing died, quote, naturally. The Earth's earliest creatures might be killed, crushed, or starved to death, but death as we know it was not inevitable." Youth, "They could live forever?" Thomas, "If the conditions were right, yes. The bacteria present on Earth today are like that. In fact, the prokaryotes alive on Earth now could possibly have existed at the very emergence of life. Some of them might be 4 billion years old. We don't know, of course, but it is a possibility. The point is this. Death was an invention of evolutionary creativity. Life does not inevitably mean death. In the beginning, death simply wasn't necessary." So here we are, says Suzanne, in this creation that evolution is, that the universe is giving forth and giving rise to all of its own aspects in this ongoing complexification. And here we are. There was never death until this came along, just like self-reflection is the most recent awesome development. Now we're going to talk about when death came along. Youth, "What a lousy deal." Thomas, "You disappointed?" Youth, "Can't we get back to that earlier way of living?" Thomas, "Would you want to?" Youth, "Well, of course." Thomas, You think the universe was mistaken when it invented death as a biological inevitability? Youth. What's gained by it? Thomas. Good question. Why would life create biological death? Let's start at our end. Suppose we eliminated natural death. The first thing that would happen would be the need to eliminate reproduction. Existing humans would, of course, want to remain among the living, and once the continents were jammed, we couldn't allow for any newcomers. Youth. All right, that sounds fine. Thomas. It sounds all right for a while, but what about a million years later? The same old humans still dragging around the planet? The same old animals? Pretty dull. The sad thing is that the anxiety over death would be a billion times worse than before, for we could still die in accidents. You'd never risk a single step outside your little hut. Why risk an eternity of life on Earth for anything the least bit dangerous? Even the animals would figure it out eventually. They, too, would huddle in caves. Who knows how far this terror would spread? Perhaps one day the sun would figure it out as well, stop burning, turn dark, and huddle inside itself forever. Life avoided that dead end of paralyzing immobility, devising instead its greatest desire and accomplishment, novelty and surprise. Look at the adventure of life all around us. Adventure, surprise, risk, and excitement. These are the fundamental desires of life. Youth. Why couldn't we have that without the anguish of knowing we're going to die? Thomas, you're being self-centered. It's not painful to live as a squirrel or an elephant, even though they too are going to die. They don't drag around all day with long faces, nor do they spend lifetimes writing dreary novels about existential angst over death, or worse, inflict a miserable fear of extinction upon everybody else. It's not difficult to live as a majestic sequoia or a pungent prairie grass, or the delicately industrious hummingbird. So this is Brian being such a beautiful poet. A majestic sequoia. A pungent prairie grass. Pungent? I didn't know it was pungent. A delicately industrious hummingbird. Ah, delish. Youth. But they don't know they're going to die. Why couldn't life stick with forms that were ignorant of their death? Thomas, an excellent question. Why did life create forms that would become aware of their own individual deaths? Let's approach this question from the point of view of the emergent cosmos. The question then becomes, what is gained for the unfolding cosmos to include particular creatures, humans, who are aware of their own deaths? Why make us aware of our deaths? To deepen the adventure of life. To underscore the drama of each instant. The universe desires to show itself. The universe is a showing of the unnameable mystery out of which being shines forth. How else could the universe feel its own staggering value? How else but through a human space aware of its own individual end? Within human self-reflection can be felt a glimmer of the supreme preciousness of being. And we would certainly not be able to feel this were it not for our awareness of death. Youth. So that's why we have to suffer the anguish of knowing our death. Thomas, it's difficult, yes. It's the task set for the human, and we suffer tremendously in our role of carrying the awareness of life's precious and fragile beauty. But our reverence is our gift to the universe. Who can feel the stupendous, fragile beauty of the great black whale soaring through the ocean but the human? We are able to feel and cherish the infinite significance of the whale as it dives into the freezing ocean to value it for what it is. That is our gift to the living world. To see it. To feel the moment. To speak it. To celebrate its truth. You might say the whale has it easy. The whale is free from the anguish of self-reflexive awareness of its approaching death. But because of that, the whale cannot feel its own beauty. Its ephemeral magnificence. That is what the human must do, or our suffering is in vain. Well, isn't that a challenge? We must feel this beauty of ourselves, or our suffering is in vain. Yes, I get it. It's a cosmic kick. So, let's get on with it. Let's be about this. But we die anyway, and our feelings end. our feeling of the whale's beauty and preciousness disappears. Thomas, it disappears in time, yes. Youth, that's what I'm saying. Thomas, you're locked into identifying with the temporal. Time is not the fullness of being. You're locked into identifying with the temporal. Time is not the fullness of being. There are existence, and there is emptiness. Both are real. The eternal, the transphenomenal, shows itself in time, yes, just as the dynamics of the cosmos show themselves in concrete events. But what is invisible is real as well. Youth, then where is the feeling of the whale's beauty? Thomas, captured, cherished, and remembered. The universe never loses anything of value. Relax. You couldn't hang on to that beauty anyway, no matter how hard you tried. Do your work, and the cosmos will do its work. Youth, I hate thinking I'll just disappear at death. Thomas, if you surprise the world with your life, the world will surprise you at death. Isn't that a good idea, Suzanne says. Okay, here it is. Another challenge. If you surprise the world with your life, the world will surprise you at death. Why not? Take a chance. Don't think of death as extinction. Such uninspired speculations are simply much too prosaic to be true. Your dull imagination insults the very grandeur and staggering wonders of this universe. See, that's why it pays, says Suzanne, to take these things in and to be moved by them to where we're not so prosaic looking at these teeny bodies with dull imaginations, but we're in the grandeur and the staggering wonder. And then everything can be incorporated in that, even our death. What an adventure we might be looking forward to. Thomas, it's all right to be immature, but don't project your callow views upon the universe. Yesterday you knew nothing about the primeval fireball or the stunning dynamics of the stars unfolding, and yet you feel qualified to say the universe was wrong in creating death? Rather than hiding from your death or repressing your fear about death, embrace your death. It will serve you. Youth, how? Thomas, by enabling you to show yourself. Precisely because you are aware of the limits of life, you are compelled to bring forth what is within you. This is the only time you have to show yourself. You can't hold back or hide in a cave. You can't waste away in a meaningless job, cramming your life with trivia. The drama of the cosmic story won't allow it. The supreme insistence of life is that you enter the adventure of creating yourself. Each instant of your life had folded into it unnameable significance. All rests on your self-creativity, for out of you comes forth ultimate reality. The dynamics that fashioned the stars are now brought into your self-reflexive awareness. And what they create is your free adventure, your surprise for the universe. Yes, death is terrifying. Do not belittle it. Do not try to reduce this. Do not project your puny ideas upon it, but use death's awareness as you would a fuel or a lamp, as a secret guide who will lead you into the unknown and mysterious caverns of yourself so that you can bring forth what you truly are. Your creativity needs your awareness of death for its energy, just as your muscles need long and painful workouts. Cherish your awareness of death as a gift to you from the universe. If you did not have this way of seeing the infinite significance of each moment, would anything have the power to get you out there to live your life? What is especially exciting about our own time is the vision of the death of the species and of the planet as a whole. Frightening, terrible, horrible, yes, certainly, but this is exactly what has the power to ignite the deepest riches within us. We can no longer live within the previous world picture. We know that we have to do something, create and change in the essential dimension of things. The terrifying vision of an earth gone black is psychic food for the human species. It brings us the energy that we need to reinvent ourselves as the mind and heart of the planet. We now take our first steps into the planetary and cosmic dimensions of being, moving out of the anthropocentric modern period and into the cosmocentric unfolding universe. Oh, maybe this is the most important section of course, each new one I come to, Suzanne says, that moves me this much, I think, oh, this is it. This is the book's deepest significance. But this is the most significant thought that he's developed so beautifully here, where you see that death is the deliverance into our moment of creativity, that the universe would not move but for, would not develop, would not evolve but for this impetus we have to serve it in this way. And now that we are threatened with such massive destruction, it is massive in impetus, which is at least a place where we can find some peace. We cannot be destroyed by the challenge. We can see that it is in the great forces of the dynamics of the cosmos that we find ourselves in a moment where everything is called for from us. And we get the energy to show up. Brian gives us this cosmic fuel. Youth asks, but what does it mean to become the mind and heart of the planet? Thomas, to live in an awareness that the powers that created the earth reflect on themselves through us. That's why we are discussing the night sky, the sea, and the land. Each of these reveals cosmic powers that we are to have and become. We are to live as alluring and remembering activity, as shimmering sensitivity. And this means the cosmic dynamic revealed by the life forms, surprise and adventure. Call it play. Adventurous and surprising play. That's what life reveals. That's what life is. Youth, and that is what we are to become? Thomas, yes. But again, we must understand something especially important. The insistence that we become adventurous play is not our insistence alone. The universe insists on it. As in each of the previous cases, the universe created our sense of adventurous play as the latest extravagance in a long history of advancing play. By enhancing it, we work with the grain of cosmic dynamics. Do you see what I'm saying? Youth, we're enhancing the movement of the universe then. Thomas, yes. Life showed surprise from the beginning. The earliest organisms advanced by a random appearance of novelty. We call this genetic mutation totally random, by which we mean that there is no controlling machine. The genes showed a fundamental freedom of activity. Nothing could predict the outcome before the appearance of the new form of life. This presence of free activity was enhanced with sexual recombination. Now entire complexes of possibilities could be played with rather than only individual units. The adventurous play of the life forms bursts into the bewildering and sublime diversity of the past 500 million years. All of this profusion of being and beauty is the outcome of play, of risk, of surprise. The creation of new life forms is not determined, but is the outcome of life's intrinsic freedom. Nor is play's manifestation limited to activity at the genetic level. Life forms play, especially the young of species. In mammals, there is a recognizable difference between the young and the old, not only anatomically, but behaviorally as well. And the most conspicuous behavioral difference is the propensity and ability to play. The young come into the earth's system of life as if play were what they were created for. They explore, cross the normal limits of things, leap about without reason, climb too far out on limbs, and fall in the water when their curiosity fastens on something new and strange there. The young reveal the core of life's mystery, the need and opportunity for adventurous play. Now let's consider the human in all this. Biologists have discovered that in the primate order, there is little genetic difference between species. The chimpanzee and the human share over 98% similarity in their gene pools, an astonishing discovery when we consider the tremendous differences between these species. But what is the essential difference? What line was crossed that created the human form and not before? Is it the size of the brain? Current thinking locates the difference between humans and other primates in the ability of the human to make play its dominant activity throughout a lifetime. Unique among species, the human makes exploration, surprising discoveries, experimentation, and above all, learning, the central activities of life itself. The human form of life can be considered the child of the earth. This is especially clear when we examine the anatomies of other primates. The head of an infant chimpanzee resembles the head of an infant human in size and shape, but as the chimpanzee reaches adulthood, its head changes in significant ways. The human head remains comparatively the same infant head, only larger. In fact, the infant chimpanzee's head looks more like an adult human's head than its own future adult shape. This dynamic in which the qualities of the young are retained into mature stages is called neoteny. We can then begin to understand the human as an eternal child. The first human types were young primates who never left their youth. The shape of their juvenile bodies were retained into adulthood, as was their youthful behavior. The great accomplishment of the human form, then, was the creation of a mature form of childhood, a form of life that, upon reaching adulthood, could continue to devote itself to a lifetime of adventurous play. So, you see what I mean when I say that life insists we develop the cosmic dynamic of adventurous play? Youth. And if we don't, it means that we are blocking life's unfolding again? Thomas, yes, that's our impasse now as a species. We can think of it this way. Each species has its own habitat, that place where the species can flower forth. If a species cannot find its proper habitat, its true powers of life cannot be evoked. A species denied its habitat perishes. We see it all around us. What is the true habitat of the human? Adventurous play. A human denied this habitat of adventure and surprise and play is denied the opportunity to become truly human. Our anguish today rests in our failure to recognize our true talent. We thought we were supposed to become full-time consumers in one great worldwide consumer society. But that brings no satisfaction, and we end up trashing the garden spots of the planet. We try to live as appendages to our machines, discovering only unrelenting meaninglessness in the midst of grime and noise. What else could we have expected, trying to live outside our habitat? Can a whale live in hydrochloric acid? Can an oak tree send down roots in a tar pit? We will finally move into our destiny when we understand that we are to live in and as adventurous play. Youth, what would this mean specifically? Thomas, who knows? That's the great thing. We can't go to any other species and ask them. That's the whole point. Adventure is an adventure into the unknown. True play is without predetermined direction or definition. We are to explore, to learn as deeply as we can, to probe and experiment, and above all, to laugh. Humor already reveals the presence of adventurous play. A deep belly laugh might be the one true cry of the human being. Don't be saddened by our lack of knowledge concerning our destiny as cosmic play. Become self-reflexively aware. Put your trust in the entire cosmic process. It has labored through 20 billion years. Believe me, you are well equipped for the job. Think of the tremendous labor of all living forms who have finally arrived at you, the ultimate child of the planet. They did their work. Now you do yours. Plunge yourself into the work of living as surprise become aware of itself. You are the essence of surprise, the heart and core of play. Show yourself as truly as you can, show yourself as truly as you can, and you will in that moment shine with the freedom and frolic and fecundity of creative play. To say that play is essential to the human species is to corroborate what creative scientists, artists, and the great saints have understood as central to our own activities. Play, fantasy, the imagination, and free exploration of possibilities, these are the central powers of the human person. The development of the earth depends on the development of the human into its destiny as the self-portrait of adventurous play. Who can say? Perhaps all the other species are capable of profound, playful exploration of relationships as well, only awaiting us to start the process. Perhaps the entire natural world is a tremendous party, a festival, and we, the long-awaited champagne. Well, that's the end of life, or the beginning of life. Well, I hope you're enjoying this as much as I am. It is so absolutely delicious to me to be reading this and to think that we are in this great adventure together, this adventure of adventurous play. So until the next time, when fire consumes us and wind blows us, have a wonderful time playing with beauty and awe and allurement and all of Brian's wonderful toys.
Thank you for listening to theconversation.org, making sense of these times. Now that you've heard from us, we'd love to hear from you. Click the feedback button on the show's webpage and share your thoughts. We'll be posting new shows approximately once a week. If you would like to be emailed when new shows are posted, let us know. This show is brought to you by MightyCompanions.org, dedicated to encouraging the awareness of ourselves as a one life and providing a meeting ground for those who share that awareness.